Good evening. It's Thursday, the 19th of September. I'm Alec Hogg, and here's your Biz News Briefing. Well, we've been talking about it the whole week. U.S. interest rates last night were cut by more than anticipated, down by 50 basis points. It was expected that they would drop by 25, and they're down now from 5.5% to 5%. The anticipation is that over the next year or so, they will decline further and get to 3%. That's having a knock-on effect all over the world. Most central banks take their lead from what happens in the United States, and indeed we did here in South Africa, but we didn't drop by 50 basis points or 0.5%. The South African Reserve Bank cut interest rates here by 25 basis points. So it is some assistance, but not as much as some might have hoped. Global markets have rallied hard. The S&P 500 index is up nearly 2%. NASDAQ up nearly 2.5%. The JSE 1.5% today. The biggest beneficiaries, small and medium caps. In other words, small and medium listed companies. I spoke with Kevin Lings earlier today. He is the chief economist at StanLib. And Kevin had some very interesting things to say about the interest rate cut and unpacked exactly what it means and how it's going to affect all of us. Kevin's interview is on Biz News TV, or rather you'll be able to get it at about 5:30. But here is a little taster of his focus, or the area that he believes is going to benefit most after the interest rate cut that we saw today, and indeed looking at the South African market in particular.
We see more value in domestic stocks, and some of those are small cap. Obviously, a lot of that will depend on each fund manager as to the size of their portfolio and how big the company is, and can they actually fit it into the portfolio. And so some of the smaller boutique asset managers have a benefit there because they can buy more easily into the smaller cap, and that can make a significant difference to their portfolio. But nevertheless, that's our exact same trend in terms of how we positioned our equity exposure. And obviously, we need two things to happen, and they're important. One is we do need the South African economy to perform better. And so this buy into cheaper South African stocks is a good strategy if the economy does better. If earnings grow and it all washes down to the bottom line, it would make a hell of a lot of good sense, and I think there is a good value there. The second thing that would help us enormously, if we start to see foreigners coming back into our market. Foreigners have been net sellers of South African equities every month for I can't remember how many months. They've tended to not like South Africa's story at all, no matter which segment you're looking at. What we need and would help us enormously is if some of this better sentiment in South Africa, a little bit, let's assume that it translates into better growth, that we start to see foreigners come into South African market looking for some of that same value. That would give us a very nice uplift. So that's our general positioning. And obviously, as we grow in confidence around the idea that South Africa can do better, then that positioning will become more aggressive. At this stage, you would have to say that we've got tentative signs of improvement. We've got a better sentiment. A lot of CEOs, when I chat to them, are expressing a better optimism, better sentiment. We think we've got better policy in place generally, but we've got a long way to go in terms of implementing some of these to make a meaningful difference to the actual economy.
Coming up in the program tonight, we are going to be talking to Sean Pesch of Ranmore Funds. That's some insight into two big companies that released results today. Sean's got a different view on them. Certainly, Remgro is a cornerstone of many South African portfolios. He doesn't like it. Discovery, one of the best South African exports in the business field. He likes it a lot. But there'll be more of that coming up in a moment. Sean was among the presenters at the BizNews conference, so we'll get his insights on what he took home. And then having a look at another bit of work from the, or bit of insight from the star of the show, Mteto Nyati, the chairman of Eskom. We'll have feedback on the Government of National Unity from France Cronier, again from that conference. And we'll also be closing off this show tonight on who the world's best hotels are and why two South African hotels actually feature on that list. But before we get there, all over the world, there is discussion at the moment about the way that warfare has gone high tech. The top story on the Financial Times today is about walkie-talkies and pagers that exploded in Lebanon over the last 2 days. At least 37 people are dead as a result. 350 people are in intensive care and 3,000 injured. Pagers, handheld radios, no longer safe. Well, it appears as though everybody is learning that the Israelis have got a level of insight into warfare, and certainly from the technical area, that was it was not appreciated beforehand. Here's our colleagues at the, or our partners rather, at the Financial Times of London.
How did someone turn thousands of pagers and walkie-talkies into small bombs? My colleague Mehul Srivastava has been following the aftermath of the blast. So let's start with the pagers that exploded on Tuesday. What do we know about how they went off?
So we don't know exactly why and how, but there's a rough theory that's fallen into place. And the theory goes something along these lines, which is that when Hezbollah started buying pagers to hand out to different members, at some point, somebody from the Israeli espionage service, the Mossad or the military intelligence, managed to get a hand on these shipments before they landed in Lebanon. And during that period, were able to swap out a few components and maybe do a little bit of malware installation on the pagers themselves. And most importantly, insert a small explosive charge in there. And at some point Tuesday, around 3:30 in the afternoon, almost all of these pagers received a single alert, which caused them to explode simultaneously. Now, let's be very clear. Nobody's proven this. This is something that's been alleged. But Hezbollah has made it very clear that they think Israel has done this.
How could Israel have gotten its hands on these pagers?
An operation of this size leaves behind a large number of clues for people to sift through, including on social media. And very quickly after the explosions happened on Tuesday, you were able to identify from the remnants of these devices that most of them came from a single company in Taiwan called Apollo Gold. And it turns out that they had, at some point, licensed that brand to a small company in Budapest. And it isn't clear whether these devices were manufactured in Taiwan or manufactured and licensed somewhere in Europe, when they were intercepted and when they got to Lebanon. But at some point in the last few months, it's clear that somebody in Lebanon placed an order for a large number of these pagers to come in, and those are the same ones that exploded.
Yeah, that's something that I was wondering about, actually. Why is Hezbollah turning to things like pagers in the first place? I mean, this is really antiquated technology.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, one of the issues was that it's well known that the Israeli military intelligence units have well and truly infiltrated communications networks around its regional rivals. And earlier this year, Hezbollah chief Hassan Nasrallah had begged his followers to give up their smartphones, because smartphones with their GPS and their cameras and the recording capabilities give away a large amount of information that would give away Hezbollah's intentions, plans. At that point, it appears around like 5 or 6 months ago that Hezbollah started importing these large batches of pagers, and then later on started importing a large number of walkie-talkies also, which we've seen on Wednesday had started exploding around Lebanon also.
So how is Hezbollah responding to the attacks?
I mean, Hezbollah is clearly furious about this, but it's also humiliated because it shows that something as important as the communications between itself and its military members and other members of what is essentially a very powerful militia not only can be compromised in terms of surveillance, but can be turned into a weapon that either disables or kills a large number of its members. And were this to have happened, say, during a wartime, it truly would have crippled Hezbollah because you need to communicate with your colleagues far away. And they've gone from cell phones to pagers and from pagers to walkie-talkies. It's not quite clear what comes after a walkie-talkie other than going completely analog in the way some of other Israel's enemies have done.
Extraordinary story, isn't it? Well, on to Sean Pesch now. He is the founder of Rand More Funds, one of the top asset managers in the world. Indeed, Morningstar ranks him amongst the top 1% globally. And he was at the BizNews conference last Thursday. I asked him what he had taken home, or rather what he will be taking home with him to London.
In terms of the BizNews investment conference, I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I must tell you a story which I didn't get to. The night before, I was staying at our place in Tiwaters Cliff, and the night before, I had drinks with friends, and we were talking about Eskom, and one of the ladies, Gail, good friend of ours, she said, "Oh, I must tell you, I worked with Mteto Nyati. The guy's brilliant." I said, "What makes him so special?" He's a great leader, and he's so collaborative, and he will bring people on side. Wow, it's amazing. I hadn't even looked at the agenda. I was so busy and so rushed to get there. I couldn't believe it. I look at the agenda the next morning, and there he is, speaker number two. So I had to go up to him and say, mention Gail's name. So it was really enlightening for me to see him speak and to hear them and to hear about the wonderful stuff that he's done. And I thought for me, he was the winner. Okay, he was up against some tough competition, but I thought Mteto Nyati was very. I thought it was a great speech. And I just think, you know, he has done remarkably well. And I think the other thing is, so often when everybody is on one side of the seesaw, everyone's negative, oh, this load shedding is going to go on forever, etc. Boom. You know, all of a sudden, like there's no load shedding. So it just shows you one's got to be careful about getting too fixated, too negative, too positive, etc. So congratulations to him and his team. And the other thing which was interesting is that you'll recall at one part in his speech, he talked about AI, joining the dots with individuals saying, well, hang on, this person does this job, but they're driving a Maserati and live in a 5 million, own a 5 million rand house in wherever, you know, and those dots don't line up. Those points don't line up and they use AI. Now, if a big corporation like Eskom is finding benefits from AI, it just shows you, and it's a point I've made before, is don't just think that the only beneficiaries of AI are NVIDIA. It's the other companies too.
Well, everybody now seems to be singing Mteto Nyati's praises. Well, not surprisingly, because we're day 176 of no load shedding, and who knows, with a bit of luck, we might get through to March next year, which was the time that the Eskom chair said we would be free of load shedding. So let's just hold thumbs for that. But not everybody believed it at the time. And indeed, when Dan Morakani, the chief executive of Eskom, was appointed, there was some notable resistance. Here is the Eskom chairman with his insights on what exactly some of the political parties, in particular the Democratic Alliance, thought of the board's decision.
And I'm quite pleased, I'm honored to actually be leading a group of people that are so competent and committed to South Africa and committed to turning around this entity of ours. One of our first tasks, of course, was to get somebody who's going to replace Andre. And we managed to find the gentleman, Dan Morakani. He's a chemical engineer. That's his junior degree. And his master's degree is a petroleum engineer from the UK. He's a great, great guy. And I mentioned this point down here that the DA rejected our choice, who is Dan Morakani. He said that he does not inspire confidence. I mean, this is right. It's like, how did you come to that conclusion? What is it that you used to to come to that conclusion? Did you just look at his face, or maybe look at his weight, or what? How did you come to that conclusion? But that is the this is the world that we're living in. To me, that point is not really about Dan as well. That point is also about the board, that these stupid fellows, these people, have decided to go and find somebody who's not inspiring. It's actually a vote of no confidence on that board as well. So I'm just saying that this is the reality that we've been operating under. None of us wanted these jobs. All of us are doing this thing. We're doing this thing for our country, which is South Africa.
Interesting insights from the chairman of Eskom. The winner, says Sean Pesh. Well, if he did win, if you have that kind of a race when you're talking about seven great keynote speakers, then a short head behind him was Frans Cronje. Frans is one of South Africa's most esteemed political commentators, and he also has a pretty good feel for the economy. So he's an excellent speaker, and I'm going to give you a highlight now from what his views are on the government of national unity. And indeed, as investors will be looking at this both locally and internationally, why it should inspire confidence.
You mentioned Gayton McKenzie, who's been a regular participant at BizNews conferences.
Oh, but he's very good in terms of strategy and understanding. He's exceptional. Now, people make the mistake of saying, well, they don't know if they like him. Or if you grew up in white suburbia, you know the chap went to prison. You don't kind of know how to relate to that, and so these issues become prejudice towards the chap. His background and understanding of the country, and of we spoke about the use of hard power, which Westerners have lost the ability to do completely because they still believe in the end of history. He's got all of these advantages. There were some politicians, well, when the negotiations were happening for the GNU and the sort of people who were discussing ministries, there was a view around that the sports ministry is kind of a stupid ministry. So you don't want to, you send a sort of moron to the sports ministry. You can't do anything with it. You know, you need a serious ministry like, well, no, trade and industry, and then you can, you know. He has been magnificent in what he's done with the sports ministry in building a political platform for himself and inspiring South Africans around.
Government of National Unity going into the future. You gave us an uplifting story, but the foreign investors kind of buy it, but haven't quite. The local companies haven't been opening the taps. We hear, I think you might have quoted it, 1.5 trillion rand in cash on South African corporate balance sheets. When are they going to get it that this could be a opportunity for them to start investing? And once they start, perhaps the foreigners will follow.
I'll tell you how that I see the conversation going with some of them, and what they say and why. And but first, a comment on relativism. Watch this. This is always going to happen on the GNU, as. We got months and months past the GNU, people will begin to become frustrated with it. And they'll forget how very, very well we did as a country to achieve that result. And they'll start to say, well, it's disappointing. It hasn't secured the growth. So the relativism will be there. Despite the enormous successes and the genius of Eskom, and the energy minister, which is what it is. The other constraints on growth, national health insurance is an existential threat because you cannot have a middle class in a society that doesn't provide world-class healthcare services. Labor market policy that prices people who are poorly educated out of the labor market. Just as 2 points are sufficient to hold back, are sufficient to make South Africa from a sort of capital investment destination not competitive enough to beat the alternatives around the world yet. In the room, if you sit in an investment bank in London and talk about South Africa, they say, firstly, they're very surprised that you guys pulled this off, or American diplomats or whatever they are, very surprised. They didn't see it coming. They thought you're on the way to catastrophe. It's good. Definitely worth a sniff, bit of a punt. You've seen that in the 10-year yield in SA. You've seen the results. There is a result. But then they will say to me, what is your growth forecast? And I'll say, "We the GNU's first obstacle is get to 2%. And as long as that remains the answer, we're not going to open the country to the capital flows that are necessary to take the GNU from, let's say, stage one success, which has been immensely good, to a point where South Africa is again one of the world's most competitive emerging markets.
Yeah, still a long way to go. Only 2% growth, and that's not going to dent anything on unemployment. National health insurance, interesting point he made there. International community sees it for what it is. Well, of course, we all want it. Everyone wants universal health care. But can we afford it? No, not as a country. We do not have the resources to find R1 trillion a year to put into health care. However, the good news there is that there is an old plan that the ANC put together in 1998 that is being dusted off by Business Unity South Africa. And on this program last night, we spoke with the deputy CEO, who explained that one of the members of the team from Business Unity that got together with Cyril Ramaphosa, the president, and his closest allies earlier this week is Richard Friedland, who is the one who was interviewed on BizNews to explain to us why this 1998 plan is actually a very good one and affordable. So let's look forward to that into the future. The other point about labor market policy that France makes there, that's a festering sore and one where sobriety is required. As he explains, by having minimum wages of the level that they are in South Africa, it's not really helping anybody. It's just keeping millions of potential workers out of the market. Staying with politics now, and every Sunday, Chris Steyn, my colleague, and Neil De Beer, the head of the United Independent Movement, talk about things to do with politics. And Neil is, well, he's forthright and outspoken. And there was a very interesting insight that he had on the government of national unity and the immaturity of some of our politicians. Let's listen in.
Now, there are two things that happened which I find on the GNU absolutely pathetic. Number one, every time you're not going to get your way, you're going to threaten to walk out. Now, I was told by a very astute soldier one day, when you pull a gun, fire. You never threaten a person with a gun. You either tell the person you are going to shoot him if he doesn't stop and then shoot him. When you take your gun out, do it. So this perpetual threat of if we don't get what we want, we are going to walk out. This is becoming pathetic. So now we've got the Bellable, which we will address today, NHI coming up. I hope the understanding of land without compensation. All those things which the pre-party and new parties brought to the table to say that we're going to save South Africa. We are going to remove the ANC. We will stand. Helen Ziller says verbatim at one stage that the Bellable is a non-negotiable.
Well, he signed a red line.
It's a red line. Well, they've passed it now. Now, what are you going to do? Move the red line. And as if you're down, we're up. Move the line. So number one, the GNU is based on a government of national unity. They put so much pressure on the DA. And then they get told, but if you sign it, we might take other options. What other options? So they didn't. They just let it get signed. The so-called Minister of Basic Education, the DA minister, decides that to absolutely protest against the signing, she's not at the signing. So one, the GNU must get its act together that it does not continue spilling to the public that Oskhan Yomura said they do, and then you don't. Number two, this continuous pathetic showmanship of Fikile act to an absolute fear, Umbalula, who now comes up on Friday and makes a statement that we don't need the DA. And if they don't want to come with ANC policy, we have other people. Did you hear? We have other people that will join us. Now, that is like tantamounting a man coming home every day and your wife tells you that if you don't want to do X, Y, and Z, I'm going to divorce you. And by the way, I have someone better than you. Wow. So dit is 'n klomp gemors. This is utter rubbish. This is not being adult. This is not being pro-citizen. This is actually ANC, DA, PA, IFP, and the other gentleman, senior actors, Nishudamurin, that joined. And while Action SA is standing there and still throwing the verbal stone, but all the parties, oh, the Freedom Front. So DA, Freedom Front, IFP, that have actually joined the GNU. They are government, Chris. Now, are we, as the people who are now settling into the OROS that we were given, that this must happen, it's better to be us than the MK and EFF. It is better to go this route, so we have now accepted it. But really, to have both parties continually sit there and attack each other and threatening to dissolve the GNU does not bode well for us. And I hope that they settle. I hope that they now become the people that we appointed to have, and that is to lead, not to actually sit there and pick high school fights.
Okay, on to the more serious stuff, I suppose, although politics is pretty serious nowadays. Remgro released financial results today for the year to end June. Its headline earnings per share fell 14%, but it has increased the gross final dividend by 15% to 184 cents a share from 160 cents a share last year. The net asset value at Remgro, according to the company, is now 251 rands a share. The share price is 147, which means it trades at a 41% discount to the net worth. Here's what Sean Pesch had to say or thinks about Remgro.
Obviously, Remgro is very tied into the South African economy, you know, with the 50% Mediclinic and OUTsurance and Air Products and all the rest. But what's interesting for me is EPS is not growing. You know, in fact, it fell to 10 rand 18. They were making 11 rand in 2013. So earnings in the last 10 years have not grown. And in fact, on a total return analysis perspective, in terms of using the price increase, share price increase, and if you'd reinvested the dividends, okay, you know, the in rand terms, it's like it's down 12% in 10 years. But in dollar terms, our 44. So for a foreign shareholder, it's been a terrible investment, okay? And it's now trading at a premium. It was trading at a premium to book. It's now at a discount to book. So you see, the market's quite smart. So it was always this wonderful business. That's why people were, they're going to add value. That's why people pay more than the underlying asset value, because they, it's almost like built in, oh, well, these guys are going to add value to that assets, those assets, okay? But they haven't done that, so now it's at a discount. But I stand back and I look at it and I go, well, hang on, they're telling me that the intrinsic value per share is 251 rand, but they only earned 10 rand. That's 4% return. That sounds pretty poor. Okay. So you haven't actually grown earnings per share, you know, and this is my intrinsic value. And I've got a 4% return on intrinsic value. That's not very good. Especially when you actually dig in there, and I mean, as I said, please bear with me, there might be something that I've completely missed, but I quickly went and had a look and said, well, how's that intrinsic value made up? You know, what is the difference between book value and intrinsic value? It's, well, you know, maybe they got into the business way back when, but now they think, management thinks it's worth a lot more. Well, a big chunk of that intrinsic value is their telecoms business, and that's losing money. So why would I pay a big number for a business that's losing money? Okay, unless it's, I really think it's a once-off. Outsurance has obviously done well. And so, you know, the problem with these big conglomerates, and that's often why they trade at a discount, is because you have every year, you have some doing well and some disappointing. Okay. And so you go, well, not again. You know, next year, maybe that business will do well and this one will disappoint. And so, you know, management, I think management need to unlock this value. And, you know, I mean, they really do. It's disappointing. And so then I thought, okay, well, how long has this management team been in place? I see they've been in place for, you know, 14 years and the CFO 9 years or so. So I stand back and look at this and I say 1.6% dividend yield, 11 times earnings, low ROE. I'm not buying this.
Also out today with financial results for the year to end June is Discovery. Its headline earnings there were up by 11%. That's headline earnings per share. The embedded value, which is kind of what we said earlier about the net asset value of Remgro, with a financial services business, the embedded value is their net asset value. That's 167 Rand a share, which is not far off the current share price at around 158. So it trades quite closely to that. Interesting to put it all together. And the value of the company, if you were to own all of the shares in that company, multiplied by the current share price, it's worth 110 billion Rand. That's how much Adrian Gore and Barry Schwarzberg, who founded Discovery, how much wealth they have created for shareholders. Quite extraordinary on a global basis, let alone in South Africa. Of the 11.5 billion Rand in profit that Discovery made, and remember, it's now a multinational, so don't get upset about what you're paying for your medical aid. Discovery Life was the biggest. It delivered 4.5 billion Rand. Discovery Health delivered 4 billion Rand. Ping An, the joint venture in China, gave Discovery 1.1 billion Rand. But on the other hand, the Discovery Bank, which is getting rave reviews and has recently just got through 1 million customers, lost 454 million Rand in the year to end June. So here is Sean Pesch on Discovery.
Well, Discovery, so obviously, you know, Adrian Gore, amazing CEO, etc. And you look at this and you just read the headlines, you know, operating income up 17%, headline earnings up 15%, NAV up 16%. Different picture, you know, embedded value. Now, what embedded value is for insurance companies is you've got your net assets, but what embedded value does is, well, hang on, you know, you've got a whole lot of policies which are going to run, and it's taking the profits, the assumed profits of those existing policies, okay, which so that you're probably going to earn in future. You know, that's up 12%. Then you have a look and you go, why is it done so well? Well, their Ping An Health Insurance JV, it's up 80 earnings, you know, now starting to contribute, up 85%. And you go, yeah, pretty impressive guy to have done a deal with Ping An
in China.
And so I look at this and I go, well, what have we got? We know, as I said on that conference, I mean, we know that share prices go up because earnings are growing. That's why Remgro hasn't gone up. Earnings haven't been growing. Okay. Well, Discovery's got some growth prospects here. It's grown earnings. It's got some growth prospects with Ping An. I mean, Ping An's only just started contributing. New business up 18%. I go, well, no surprise that on a total return basis, Discovery's up 61% over the last 10 years, where Remgro, you know, pretty much nothing. And even in dollar terms, up 3%. So at least it's been a decent business. So I mean, and it's on 12 times forward earnings. You know, so I'm going, well, this is almost the same valuation as Remgro. It's really no competition.
No competition if you have a look at the ratings, as he puts it, between Discovery and Remgro on the one that he will be buying. Well, on the JSE today, the top 40 index was up by 1.25%. It kind of eased off towards the end, but still a very good performance, pulled higher by the 50 basis point interest rate cut that we saw in the United States and a similar news here in South Africa, although the decline in South African interest rates is 25 basis points, or about a quarter of a percent. It's going to help on your bond repayments and other repayments. And one, as we've heard through the week, it should also give the economy a little bit of a lift. But the good news here is that the South African Reserve Bank has got a lot of runway to decline interest rates or cut interest rates in the months to come. The rand eased back towards the close, but at one point had got to as strong as 17.40 against the US dollar after being at 17.60 for before ending the day at around 17 rand and 50 cents. If you own Bitcoin, well, you can afford yourself a little pat on the back tonight, because that was up 5%. It's now sitting at $63,300 per Bitcoin. So a really good session for Bitcoin, jumping by over $3,000 today. New highs for Southern Sun. We spoke about that yesterday. The trading statement coming out, the share price was up 7% today. It's at a new 12-month high. Also, those who follow the biz news gurus, including Piet Viljoen, will recall that Lewis Stores is one of his picks. That got to a new high after a 4% increase today. And Finbond, which we covered earlier in the week, got another 4% improvement today. So it has been a pretty good time for the shareholders of Finbond. That after they did a transaction in the United States where they bought out minorities in a business that they own there. Biggest move of the large caps today was Impala Platinum, 6.3%. And Naspers was up by 4%, Anglo Platinum up 5.25%, and Prosus, which is the stablemate of Naspers, was 4%. Those are big moves. Anglo American 3.7%, so good news on that side. As far as the medium caps are concerned, well, there, Bytes Technology, which is a spin-off from Altron, the group that Mteto Nyati used to run and did so well at, that went up by 9.5% today after its financial results were released. Tsoho Sun was 4.5%, no doubt enjoying a little bit of benefit from what it's the numbers that came out from Southern Sun. We Buy Cars was 3.5% higher. And as far as the small caps are concerned, well, over there, you can have a look at Lewis's 6% increase. Mustek, which had results today, was 5.5% higher as well. Well, we close off tonight with a fun story and some pretty good news for a South African-owned hotel, or two South African-owned hotels. An organization called World's Best puts together a list of the 50 best bars, the 50 best restaurants, and the 50 best hotels in the world. And what it does, it's got 600 anonymous contributors who supply names of the best hotels they have stayed in all over the world. It compiles these into a single list and then ranks them accordingly. The best hotel in the world this year is Capella in Bangkok, which displaced last year's winner, Pasalaka. Kersner International, the late Sol Kersner's company, its hotel Atlantis the Royal jumped into the top 10. So I suppose we can half claim that. That was number 9 from position number 44. But South Africa's contribution there were two hotels this year, only one last year, and they are the Mount Nelson that came in at 28, and Singita Kruger National Park, which just made the top 50, it came in at number 44. Well, I asked one of the, hotel industry's gurus, but also a man who is a little skeptical about these awards, to give me some insight into what it all meant. Let's just listen in on what he had to say.
I'm also on the World 50 Best right now, and they actually, it sounds different to most other awards out there. Mm. Doesn't cost anything to be listed. No, there's no cost to be listed or to be eligible for voting. We want a strict no pay-to-play policy. hotels are chosen by 600 experts in the academy and they cannot pay. Very, very different to pretty much all the other awards that I looked at. There, it might be the one exception. Difficult to say how legitimate this now really is. Generally, I personally am more a fan of user-generated content. So looking at the likes of TripAdvisor and Google, even though, of course, they are also, you know, it's also possible to manipulate those, but it's better than a black box of where you don't know what experts are now rating it and what are their internal criteria.
The impression I got was it's a little bit like a Michelin star, where you've got the anonymous people who go around there and they give a ranking. So it might be better than the normal one. But I suppose the main thing here is, are these two the best South African hotels? If you were in an argument with somebody and they said to you, the best hotels in South Africa are the Mount Nelson and Singita in the Kruger Park, would you take issue with them?
I would sense that they are obviously looking for a certain iconic factor and history and legacy that comes with it. And certainly these two hotels have earned that over the years and are not just high-end luxury properties, but luxury properties that have a longer trading history than most other accommodation providers in the country. Now, we don't know all the internal criteria, whether there's, you know, a certain amount of free nights being thrown at people that are known to be judges in these competitions. Because in the end, how many of those 600 judges really did stay at least one night in one of these two hotels in the last 12 months? Reputation that plays a role.
That's Randolph Jorberg, who is one of the gurus in the hospitality industry in South Africa. And I caught him at 1:30 in the morning in Silicon Valley, where he is at the moment, and still working, as South Africans do, no matter where they are in the world. Just to bring you up to date, right now, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 1% in the United States, the NASDAQ Composite 2.75%, and the S&P 500 index is 1.75%. Well, that's our BizNews briefing for today. We'll be back on Monday with a surprise. Well, more than a surprise. Look forward to seeing you live at 5 on Monday. Until then, cheerio.